Today we're going to hear a bit about federated learning from Yasmin. Take it away.
Thank you. So, yeah, hi, I'm Yasmin, and yeah, the topic will be federated learning, and it's in English, so I hope it's okay for you. I first will talk about a bit about myself. I'm working as a data scientist, but I also have a security background. I was a former pen tester, and currently I'm studying at Technische University Darmstadt, my master, computer science. And I will start my master thesis in July about the evaluation of generative models. And I have also some fun hobbies, I like Dungeons and Dragons, like a lot of other people here, I guess, and painting. So, and if some of you have questions after the talk, just talk to me or write me an email. Yes, so let's start. So first, I will give you a short overview. Where are we? We are in the field of artificial intelligence, and we have two subspaces in artificial intelligence. And AI is actually the simulation of human intelligence in machines, programmed to think like humans. So well-known tasks are, for example, understanding natural language or recognizing patterns, or also rule-based systems like in medical diagnostic systems, or, for example, also game playing like chess programs. And machine learning is one subset of AI, which is actually just math, a lot of statistics and math. And we use that to improve system performance on tasks through data, for example, in financial modeling, like in stock price prediction, or in anomaly detection, like in fraud detection, or you can also use time series analysis for weather forecasting. And today, we are in the part of the deep learning, in which we have a lot of neural network with many, many layers. And this involves a lot of tasks with a lot of data, and very much a lot of data, and complex patterns. And we have a lot like architectures like generative adversarial networks, which are well known for generating images. We have also sentiment analysis, for example, or autonomous systems like in autonomous driving or robot process automation. So, what are deep neural networks? In here you see an example of a multi-layer perceptron. Multi-layer perceptron. And as the name says, it has multiple layers, an input layer, an output layer, and some hidden layers in between. And those layers consist of neurons. Those neurons have different values, which will change over time during the training. And neurons receive inputs and from the previous layers, and the result is passing through those neurons with the help of an activation function. And those activation functions introduce nonlinearity into the model to learn complex patterns. And the input, you get raw data, for example, a dog. And this dog will go through the network, and then you will get it classified. So, for example, when you have a German Shepherd, then and you want to classify it, it goes through the network. And the perfect output would be in the output layer, yes, this is a German Shepherd. What the deep neural network does depends a bit on the task. We could, for example, also use single neurons for binary classification, which are just two classes. Or we can use multiple neurons for multiple classification, as you can see here. Okay. And we also have different type of architectures, for example, convolutional neural networks, or like the generative adversarial networks, which are doing image for data generation. And we have recurrent neural networks, which are used for sequential data, and we have autoencoders, and so on. So a lot of interesting architectures. So how does a neural network actually learn? We have forward propagation and we have backward propagation. And by the forward propagation, the input data is passed through the network layer by layer. And each neuron processes the input, applies some weights and biases, and passes the result through an activation function to the next layer until the output layer produces a prediction. And in the back propagation, we're actually doing just we're doing the same thing, just the other way around. So we're adjusting the weights and biases in the network to minimize the loss, and this involves the gradient of the loss function with respect to each weight, and then updating the weights using gradient descent. Okay, now I just said a lot of stuff you didn't hear about, so now I just need to explain what is actually loss. So, yeah, for example, you have a dog, it goes through the network, and then the network said, I think that's a cat, but it should have been a dog. So the loss is actually the difference between the right output, which was the dog, and the wrong output, which is the cat. And because it's wrong, the value of this loss is quite big. And our goal with the training is to get that value smaller and smaller in a way that we are like nearer to the right output with time. So the loss function measures the difference between the predicted output and the actual target values. And it's guiding the optimization process to adjust the model parameters and minimize the difference during the training. We use also a lot of different loss functions. For example, we could use mean squared error or cross entropy loss. And the gradient is a vector that represents the partial derivatives of the loss function with respect to the model parameters. So we use that actually to go in the right direction, so we will find the perfect output. And the direction and the rate of change is needed to minimize that loss function. And those gradients are computed through the during the backpropagation and used by optimization algorithms to adjust the model parameters, guiding the model to improve the accuracy. Okay. So now we know how to train a model, okay, but we need data. And I just told you we need a lot of data. So the data consists actually, we have three different types of data. The training data, the testing data, and validation data. We use training and testing through the learning and the validation after the model has finished learning. The training data is used to teach the machine learning model, containing input and output pairs with known outputs. We have data which is labeled, so that means you have a dog, and you also need to say your model, okay, that's a dog. So you have to give him the information too, so the image and an information that's a dog. And that training data is used so that the model can learn the patterns and relationships within the data. And the testing data is used to tune and to optimize the model hyperparameter through training. Also when we use backpropagation, we will use that testing data. And when we finished, we use the validation data at the end to evaluate the final model's performance on data it has never seen before. So we can see how is the accuracy on real life. Okay, data is a very, it's not an easy topic when it comes to machine learning. And we have a lot of problems when it comes to getting training data. So for example, the data has to be clean, it has to be accurate, it has to be free of errors. And when we have poor quality data, then also your model performance will be just bad. So the model will just be as good as your data is. We need a large amount of data to perform well, and it has to be labeled. That is also difficult and expensive, and it needs a lot of working hours to label that data. So yeah, it must be pre-processed, and we have to handle missing values. We have also another problem, which is, for example, in areas like hospitals, privacy and security of data. For example, if you want to train a model on skin cancer, you need patient data. And it is, but it's not allowed to give those patient data out of the hospital. It has to be, you have to keep it in the hospital, and it's not allowed to spread any patient information. We have also another problem when it comes, for example, to diseases which are quite rare. For example, some rare skin or some rare cancer types, we will not have a lot of data to train our model on. So that's one big problem. And another problem is also that the data has to be diverse. For example, when you have this skin cancer problem and you only train it on white skin, then it will not be it will not work on any other type of skin. So you have to look out that it's diverse and representative of different kind of patients, and you have to avoid biases and ensure that it performs well across different populations. So, okay, we have this problem with the privacy, and we have the problem that with some rare cancer types, for example, we have not a lot of data. So what could we do to make it still happen? So we could use federated learning. And federated learning is a good solution when you have limited training data, and it enables multiple institutions to collaboratively train a model without sharing the need of sharing the data. So how does that work? Each institution trains the model locally on its own data and then sends the updated model parameters like gradients or weights to the central server, which is here the aggregator. And then the server aggregates those updates and creates an improved global model, which is then sent back to the institutions for further local training. So in here you can see three different clients. In my example, this would be three different institutions. And those institutions can then train locally. And we will do this multiple times, iterating, until the global model gets better and better in predicting something we wanted to predict. And we still can preserve data privacy and security. And we don't need to share anything, so that problem is solved. Perfect. Okay. There are different types of techniques how we can aggregate the local changes to the global model. One which is used broadly is the federated stochastic gradient descent, which coordinates the training of global model by aggregated gradient updates from multiple distributed clients at each iteration. And each client computes the gradient of the loss function on its own local data. These gradients are sent to the central server, and the central server aggregates the gradients by averaging and updates the global model parameters accordingly. And the updated model is then sent back to the clients for the next round of gradient computation. We have also another technique, which is federated averaging. And this is used more often than the federated SGD. And we still have some multiple local updates, model updates, and the communication is a bit less than with Fed SGD. And each client trains the model locally for several epochs using its own data. And after local training, the clients send the updated model weights to the central server. And the central server averages these locally updated model weights to form a new global model. The updated global model is then sent back to the clients for further training. There are also different settings how we can do federated learning. For example, we have the mobile setting, and in here you have a lot of different devices like laptops, smartphones, or tablets. And normally these devices have not as much computational power and not that much of data. It is more anonymous. And it's normally just low performance devices, but a lot of them. And in cross-silo setting, about which we will talk today, we have some known servers or devices with a lot of computational power and a lot of data. Those clients are known, and they are quite powerful. But data is still a problem. We have different types of how we can train the federated learning system. And in a perfect world, every client would have just the same data. For example, when I take three classes, we have a guinea pig, we have a horse, and we have a dog. In a perfect world, every client would have just these three types of classes. Everything perfect, no problem. The model will just learn perfect. The performance would be fine. But normally, like for example in hospitals, hospitals don't have the same data. For example, one hospital has a specific lung cancer, a specialization in lung cancer. The other one does brain surgeries or something. And then those hospitals have different kinds of data. So it happens more often that we have non-IID data. So one client has, like for example, in my example with the horses, one client has a horse, the next client has a dog, and the next client has a guinea pig. This is a bit more complicated to train on. But that's the more likely case. But you also can have just a lower IID degree. For example, that with the normal IID data, you have three classes, and with a lower IID data, for example, you have just two classes. So that the first client has dog and horse, and the next one has horse and guinea pig, and the last one has dog and guinea pig. Okay, so what am I talking about? We have two types of data, which is IID data and non-IID data. And in practice, federated learning is normally non-IID data, so that different devices or institutions have very different kind of data and labels, and normally have a specific demographic type of illness compared to another. And the performance struggle is with non-IID data much harder and requires more complicated techniques to handle the training. Okay, so what are the benefits in here? We have a better privacy protection, so the data does not leave my hospital. We have reduced latency, so like two different hospitals can train in the same time because we have a centralized server. And yeah, it can be accelerated. We have regulatory compliances, as it's easier to compliance with data privacy laws, and we can also use continuous learning, so clients can join or drop at any time and continue the training permanently if required. So we can, for example, train for months or for years if we need that. But we have still also some challenges, which is, as I told you, the data heterogeneity, so that we have different devices with different kind of data. But we also can have system heterogeneity. For example, when we have one hospital with super modern hardware, which has a lot of computational power, and then you have another one with Windows NT. So, well, that's a problem. You also can have privacy concerns. We have still to look after our data, so we will not lose it. We have still to look if the model is robust and if it's not poisoned or broken or something. And we have still look about fairness and bias. It's still a problem when you just train our data on male persons, but you also have females with the same disease, and then it's just not working anymore because we didn't have the examples of females with the disease. So, but I am actually talking about today about the different kind of attacks. I will give you a short introduction to the attacks, and I brought three kind of attacks with me to present to you, which are privacy attacks, which is about data reconstruction. I have untargeted poisoning, which is more about how to disturb the machine learning process. And I have target poisoning, which is more about backdoor attacks. So in privacy attack, it's about data reconstruction. So this involves an adversary intercepting my model updates. So the updates which went from the client to the global server, and we're trying to use that information to get the original training data. So this compromises the privacy, of course, and the sensitive data can be inferred from the updates. We also have the untargeted poisoning attacks, and this occurs when the adversary manipulates the training data or the model updates of one or more clients to disrupt the learning process. And this results in a degraded global model, and it just performs poorly on a lot of tasks afterwards. And the last one would be target poisoning attacks, which are backdoor attacks. And in here, we are just trying to alter some training data and model updates of specific clients, and we're trying to insert a hidden behavior or backdoors into the model, global model. So the goal is to trigger the model to make some incorrect predictions, but just on certain inputs, while appearing totally normal on everything else. Okay, for example, this would be some examples for backdoor attacks during the training time. And we could use as some backdoor attack a small red rectangle in an image, or some really big square or whatever. But I will show you a lot more later. And what could this lead to? So for example, when you're finished training and you try to predict some images, you have, for example, an image of a cat, but during training, you put some noisy images in it, so the training was disturbed. And now when you give that image to your model, then it just said, I don't know, the image was disturbed, it looked weird, maybe it's a dog. But yeah, the training will be just not as good anymore. Yeah, but let's start with privacy attacks, the data reconstruction. So yeah, I told you the goal is to try to intercept and analyzing updates, which were sent from the client to the global model, and we are trying to reconstruct the original training data. We also try to breach the privacy of the data held by the individual clients. How can we do that? So during the federated learning process, the client sends periodically updates to the central server, and those updates contain information about the data influence on the model parameters. Those malicious clients intercept these updates, and they can get information about the training data that produces those gradients. Normally, they do that using some mathematical techniques, and normally, they also have prior knowledge to reconstruct the training data from the intercepted gradients. I will give you three different examples how you could do that. We have, for example, we could use model inversion attacks, in which we reconstruct the input data from the model parameters and the output. And by observing how the shared model's parameters change during the training, the attackers can infer sensitive information about the training data. It observes the updates to the shared model parameters during the federated learning processes and tries to analyze those changes. We could also do membership inference attacks, in which the attackers try to determine whether a specific data point was part of the training data set by analyzing the model's output. So the attacker queries the model with specific data points and observes the model confidence scores or outputs. And afterwards, they compare these outputs against a set of reference outputs obtained from models trained on different data sets. And based on the difference in the model outputs, the attacker infers whether the data point was included in the training set. Or, for example, another one would also be property inference attacks. the goal is to get the properties of the data that weren't intended to be shared, such as inferring sensitive attributes about groups or users. So we try to analyze the parameters of the trained model to find patterns and correlations that reveal underlying properties of the data. And we are trying to infer sensitive properties about data, even if those properties were not explicitly part of the model's learning objective. We can also try to defend ourselves and strengthen our model. For example, the aggregation of the model anonymizes the individual contributions. And therefore, even if attacks are able to extract information, this cannot be traced back to the clients. So we can do this. But in our case, the server still has access to the local models of the individual clients to secure the aggregation technique and restricts this access. We could also just use encryption. So we encrypt the clients before they send the information to the global server. And we could use, for example, methods like homomorphic encryption. And then the server performs the aggregation while the client's updates being decrypted, encrypted. And after aggregation, they will decrypt the global model update. We could also use secure multi-party computation, which allows multiple parties to jointly compute a function over the inputs while keeping those inputs private. And in federated learning, this can be used to aggregate model updates without revealing individual updates to the server. Each client splits its model updates into shares and distributes the shares among multiple parties. The parties perform the aggregation operation collaboratively on their shares without revealing the actual updates. And the aggregated result is reconstructed from the shares and used to update the global model. You could also use random masking, which just involves adding a random value, which is the mask, to the model update before sending them to the server. And the server aggregates these masked updates and can remove the mask during or after the aggregation to obtain the true global update. The clients then send the masked updates to the server, and the server or another third party aggregates the mask update and removes the random mask to obtain the glue model, the true global update. So now we come to the next attack type, which is on-target poisoning. And the goal in here was to disturb the learning process. So we try to inject malicious data, and we try to introduce some errors into the training process, so the performance will get worse. The primary goal is not just to misclassify specific parts, it's to disrupt the whole learning process. So it will be performed poorly on everything, on every task. And how can we do that? Well, we can add corrupted or misleading data to the training set on one or more clients. And we can, for example, randomly generate those data, we can mislabel them, or we can otherwise manipulate them to confuse the model during training. Or we can also just manipulate the gradients, which are sent to the central server. And those manipulated updates can mislead the aggregation process, introducing errors into the global model. We can also try to learn incorrect patterns, leading to significant degradation in overall performance. So the goal is to disrupt the training process, so we have not a stable solution for our model. Our goal is also that a degradation of the model performance. So maybe it worked well before, but now it should be worse. We can also try to subtly degrade the performance of the model. So we introduce slight errors or biases that subtly reduce the model's effectiveness. So we will maybe not raise a suspicion immediately. We can also try to revert the already achieved training results. And the goal could be also to erode trust so that participants and stakeholders say, well, I will not trust those federated learning systems anymore. This looks not like something I want to have. So let's just try a simple attack. I already explained to you how the federated learning in general works. We have a client, it receives the global model. We use the global model on our local training data and train it. And then we submit the trained model. And okay, but now we want to do stupid stuff with this. So we could just submit randomly initialized models, which has a random model that has baseline performance. So it's actually not hard. Let's just try to introduce... it's actually not a lot of effort. So it's simple, low effort, easy, fun. But we also can, but we know it's easy. So we also need to defend our models. So one thing to do that could, in target poisoning, could be differential privacy. And it's a combination of a clipping approach and the adding of some Gaussian noise. To prevent sensitive information leakage from the training data. And the gradient clipping, that works like we have to limit the influence of a single data point. So we will scale down all our gradients to a threshold C. So that gradient clipping works by limiting those magnitude of the gradients to prevent any single data point from having a too big influence on the model update. And specifically the norm compared to the predefined threshold, if a gradient norm exceeds C, is scaled down so that the norm equals C. Afterwards, we use a noise addiction, so we try to obscure the individual contributions, and we will add Gaussian noise to do that. There's one big problem. We have to find a good threshold C. So when the boundary is too high with our threshold, we will have an insufficient protection. But when it's too low, the training is slowed down too much. So the training will also not work at all. So, okay, just an overview. So the goal was to reduce the model's effectiveness and to distract models. We have also the easy approach to evaluate the model on a test set and just to look to monitor if there are some performance drops after training with some clients. That would be the easiest way. But we have also the challenge with the non-IID data. So when the hospitals have two different data, it's not that easy to detect some attacks because there can some performance drops of different clients. Due to the different training data. So it's harder to identify if a performance drop is due to an attack or just a result of data heterogeneity. And we have to find a robust detection mechanism, need to find out what was a malicious attack and what was just due to some data changes. We can use different defense mechanisms. We could, for example, also use outlier detection. So we just try to identify and isolate updates that significantly deviated from the norm. So we could use different techniques for that, like, for example, statistical methods like Z-scores or Mahalanobis distance. But we also can try to use some simple machine learning methods like clustering or anomaly detection. We could also just implement a robust aggregation so that the aggregation methods are less sensitive to extreme values, ensuring that the global model remains robust even if some clients are compromised. There are also different techniques to do that. For example, median aggregation, which aggregates using the mean instead, the aggregates updates are taking the median instead of the mean, which is less affected by outliers. We could also just use trimmed mean, which exclude extreme values before calculating the mean. Or we can also use KRUM, which selects an update that is close to the majority of the updates, so ineffectively filtering outliers and malicious updates. Okay, now we come to the last part, which is target poisoning and backdoor attacks. And the goal was to introduce some hidden behaviors or triggers and to cause the model to perform normally on most inputs, but on some specific inputs, it should just behave weirdly. We can do that using specific patterns or noise, like you saw before in the cats. We can also use we can use a lot of different stuff to do that, but I will just show you on the next slide. So, for example, we want to have specific word predictions. We have the word prediction, Karlsruhe is a beautiful city, but I don't like Karlsruhe, so I just want to have it guided in a bad way, so it says Karlsruhe is it's a horrible city. You could use backdoors to get to that point at the end. Or, for example, I have a specific kind of cat, like I have black cats, but I only want to have the trigger on black cats. So when my model classifies a black cat, it will think, oh no, that's a dog. So that's some ways what we could do in here. We could, for example, insert some specific patterns in our cats. For example, here you have a red and blue trigger pixel pattern. And then you will just tell the model, that's a dog with this pixel pattern. And then it will go through the model, and the model will be confused on some inputs and say, yeah, okay, now it's a dog. So we could do that. So the objective is introduce malicious data during the training phase through embedding triggered patterns and using backdoor target labels. So the malicious data samples are added to the training data set to influence the model's behavior and to corrupt the model learning process, causing it to make incorrect prediction. Yes, we could also defend ourselves, of course. So I just mentioned clustering some slides ago, and a quite good approach to defend ourselves from backdoor attacks is clustering. What is clustering? With clustering, we are trying to identify and filter out malicious data from the data training set, and therefore protecting the integrity of the machine learning model. When we use clustering methods, we try to cluster different data points together. So, for example, we had the dog, the guinea pig, and the horse before. Those are three classes, and when you would use clustering, you would see that, like, in one cluster, there's only guinea pig, and the next one is horses, and the next one would be dog, yes. So then when you have malicious data, which is like has a weird, some weird pixel patterns or something, and it is a dog, but it does not look exactly like all the other dogs. So it would not be in the dog cluster, and it would just be somewhere else. So you would know, okay, that is malicious data. We can use different clustering techniques for that. For example, we could use k-means, which is, with k-means, we partition data into k-clusters, where each data point belongs to the cluster with the nearest mean. But we could also use density-based spatial clustering on applications of noise, which is dbScan. And dbScan identifies clusters based on the density of data points, which allows it to find arbitrary shaped clusters and detect outliers. But we could also use hierarchical clustering, which builds a tree of clusters by iteratively merging or splitting existing clusters. So So yeah, those anomalies would not fit in well into any cluster, or maybe it was just built also one small cluster somewhere else. So we would know, okay, that does not belong in our training data. And then we can just filter those data. So we can remove those identified outliers and inconsistent clusters from the training data set. And we can ensure that the remaining data used for the training is clean and reliable, so we can protect the model from being compromised. We have just one problem. When we have no malicious data and we use clustering, then we will just cluster out the smallest cluster with good data. So you have to be sure that you have some malicious data in it. So here you get a small overview about different kind of backdoor attacks or areas. And there's still many more stuff I could talk about, for example, about scaling attacks, which you can see over there somewhere, in which attackers can amplify or diminish the gradient updates, or I could also talk about training process manipulation. If you are interested, there's much more to the topic to talk about. And this is just a short introduction due to the time I have. And if there's interest, if someone is interested, you can just write me an email, or maybe I will do a second talk. I don't know. I will see that. So I want to say thank you for listening. And I want to say special thanks to Philipp Rieger from System Security Lab at TU Darmstadt for the given support. And the provided content is also based on his lecture. And I want also to say thank you to all my friends for providing me with cute pet images. And those is the starring of all the cute creatures which were in the lecture, or I mean in the talk. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Yasmin, for this interesting talk about federated learning and its security aspect. Now, are there any questions? Yes.
Could you elaborate on how differential privacy helps out with untargeted poisoning, as the clipping part will reduce the influence of malicious parts, but the adding noise part, that is also part of differential privacy, why destroy the good data?
No, it will not destroy data. It will just destroy. It will not destroy anything. It will just help with. So you will not get the information about the gradients. But when you put some noise to the gradients, you will not destroy any data with it.
All right, any further questions?
Is it correct that this is not possible in German law unless every patient does sign and
yes.
Formula and stuff like this?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Any more questions?
So a lot of the talk has been focused on like servers which are most likely in institutions like hospitals trying to manipulate your data model. I'm just a bit curious, like why would an institution, like why would a server return bad data to you on purpose? Or why would an institution like, why would you expect an institution to potentially return bad data?
No, we actually not expect institutions to insert some malicious data, but it still can happen that you have some attackers on hospitals, which then try to introduce some bad data into it. So the hospitals normally just, the only thing which may happen when you have hospitals that they may introduce some low quality data, but the intention would never be to insert malicious data.
I didn't quite get, you talked about how clustering may help to rule out the data which is low quality or bad or intentionally wrong, but as far as I understood, you only get the model, right? So how do you know that there was data in there if you don't have it to perform clustering to rule it out? Because then the local party would have to do the clustering, right? And if it's malicious, they probably won't say, oh yeah, that's the data I put in there on purpose.
Yes, but the global model also knows the different type of data we're using. So I don't know how to explain that, actually. I'm sorry. no, I don't. I'm sorry, I can't explain it.
To the same point, if I understood correctly, the clustering is performed on the model updates sent by the institutions, right?
It's performed on the data, on the different classes of data we have, not on the models.
Okay, that removes one of my questions. How is this typically managed in terms of how are the updates generated? Would your institutions typically on a certain interval train on their full data sets, or is it incremental updates?
Normally, when you have, you just train on your data set, and when you get new data set, you start to train again, and you will produce some changes, and then those changes will be sent to the global model. Is that helping?
On that note, so technically older data could be reintroduced if, for example, misdiagnoses were detected.
Yes, but it would be a lot of work to do that.
Okay, thank you.
So unlearning is still, it's still a big problem when you have, for example, you train for months and then someone just put in some some data which was very low quality, and then the performance is bad, and it's still a research area how to do to remove that data from your global model again. So it would be, that's still a big problem, and you just need to start learning again.
Any further questions?
Would I be correct to assume that the variance between the institutions is the variance between the data of the institutions is the main challenge, and distinguishing that inherent variance from malicious variance, in essence?
Yes, exactly.
So your clipping ideas or whatever would also limit the effect of valid data.
Exactly, and that's also the thing with the threshold. Like you need to find something in between which works with malicious data and with not just clipping important data.
I would assume that pre-processing is an important part of this whole
aspect.
That's
also very important. Yes.
How do you do distributed pre-processing without, how do you design a pre-processing pipeline without looking at the data of the institutions, is what I'm asking, essentially.
Well, actually, the data of every distributions is built differently. For example, you also have different machines. When you have different scanning machines, they sometimes, for example, the coloring on the images are different. So every hospital actually has to do the pre-processing on its own, because you can't just form one pre-processing for all the data. It's not working.
Thank you.
So your examples were about dogs, cats, and horses. And let me ask the question based on that. So if you train to distinguish between cats and dogs and horses, what do you also do labeling of like other animal types, like a wolf or a lynx or something like that. Is that part of the strategy? Do you do that? So like you go with the hospital example. Mm-hmm. There's somebody coming in and he doesn't have cancer at all. Mm-hmm. You don't know that he you think he has mm-hmm. cancer. Mm-hmm. You just want to know which cancer type, but he has still allergy or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's something else. So how do you deal, and is this part of the consideration here?
It's not part of the federated learning process, but it's part of the actual medical diagnostic process. And when you have AI in medical diagnostic, the rules are more stricter with any other AI stuff. For example, when I will give you an example with skin cancer or no, I don't know, with some cancer types. And when you have a cancer which is not included in the types we trained on, then we will have a special implementation which says that's not in the stuff we learned. So there is, I forgot the name actually on that, but in medical AI, it's how they do it, that they implement a special, a special implementation that they say, no, that's not in it. I don't know it. So yes, that's actually part of it, but not of the federated learning process in here.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the talk. As it is so difficult with the German privacy laws to get like raw data, is there an effort in other European countries to get a good base model together, basically, so eventually the German doctors can use it, which is just not trained on German data?
I don't know about other laws in Europe.
I've got a question about different data sources. So different hospitals use, I would assume that they use different equipment to
yes.
photograph and make pictures, make other sensory inputs.
Yes.
So how much in practice does this disturb the learning process?
Well, it depends on the pre-processing. When you have hospitals with... Yeah, it still depends on the pre-processing. You need to find a baseline for all the hospitals and how they pre-process their data. But for some parts, it's still a big problem to find a baseline when the images are so different that it will not work to combine them in training. For example, I can give you an example with stencil. When one hospital uses purple stencil in tissues and another one uses blue stencil in tissues, it will not work on that. One approach for that would be to train a generative model. So they tried it to do with normalization techniques, but that's not good enough. And another approach would just to train a generative model with all the different stencils to get some data which is normalized, so we can train on that. But that's a big problem, yes.
I have a question about the training data extraction. Your talk mainly focused on Man in the Middle attack, capturing the updates. But those updates will end up in the public global model. So yes. How to prevent a training data extraction of the private data from the public global model then?
I don't understand. I'm sorry. So, I don't understand the question.
So many papers have shown that you can extract training data from trained neural networks because mm-hmm. they have so many parameters and they don't generalize well sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when the data ends up in the global model,
okay.
it may be possible to extract it.
That could be, but that could be, but I don't know how to prevent that. I didn't look about over that part.
Truth.
Thanks for the talk. As I saw it, you're talking about medical imaging, and you are aware also that every person labels differently. So the quality of your label data is not going to be that high. So how are you? Are there techniques to deal with that problem? Because the data quality is going to go down. So.
The labeling should always be the same, because you have an image and then you have, like, normally I give you a simple example. You have images in a folder and that folder says cat. That's, for example, a way how to label something. Then you give the folder in and it knows, okay, that's cat because it stands on the folder. But the labeling normally should be always the same. The biggest problem is the pre-processing, so we can make the images high quality.
I'm talking about the medical imaging.
Yes.
You know, if you have, for example, that picture you have from Stefan, and you have a segmentation problem there,
mm-hmm.
and the regions that I'm labeling are not going to be the same as you are labeling.
That's
the point.
Yeah, that's also a big problem. You could solve that in different ways. The baddest idea would just say the doctors should do it, because they know how it looks like, because doctors are expensive and they have better things to do. So you need to find someone normally paid, which is doing the labeling, and you need to train them so they will label correctly. That's also a problem, yes. So you have also, you need to look afterwards if the labeling is correct, and if it's not correct, it will not work. Yes.
May I say something for this? The picture of Stefan, you would normally break it down into subcategories, like, okay, the cortex is fine, the hypothalamus is fine, the spine is fine, whatever in the medical.
Yes.
Words, no pathology, and your model would have to do the same. And so you wouldn't have this whole picture and the doctor saying a lot of text, but you would break it down into small parts, and the machine would probably just learn, okay, this is how this part of the brain normally looks. And that's it. The problem with them, pictures of Bildgebung, whatever, with some medical pictures, is that there is a lot of variance in it that isn't pathology. Like you put someone through CT and you have, like, okay, I don't know the English word, but whatever, Nierenzysten, Leberzysten, stuff like that, no real consequence out of it, but it looks different than in your book. And I think this putting this out would be the biggest problem in it.
You can also calculate the differences. When you have, for example, this image of the brain and you see a difference, like you have a normal image of a brain, which is no illness or whatsoever, and then you have something which is growing, you also can calculate the growing part. So you can also just compare to a sane image or non-illness image. That's also possible.
Any further questions?
Hi, thanks for the cool talk. I was wondering, if there is a medical image that covers more than one condition, for example, two illnesses are shown in one picture, how would you expect your model to behave then? Would this be filtered out by clipping or clustering or whatever? Because then it would truly match two classes at once.
This is also possible, yes.
Any more questions? Okay, then one from me. How widespread is federated learning as of now?
Not that much. Because, well, I told before, it's pretty cool, but we have a lot of hospitals which work on very old operation systems, so I hope it's getting more. It's getting more with the years, but at the moment we still have the technology problems in hospitals.
Okay. It seems now is a good time to stop because the time's up. Once again, thank you very much for the